Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Mark Malkoff, who's been on this podcast before, is such a funny guy, crazy guy, does experiments with his life all the time. Like even, I remember one time, he stayed on an airplane and just, he traveled on an airplane for 30 straight days without leaving the airplane because he wanted to get over his fear of flying. But anyway, Mark is an obsessive fan of all things Bill Murray. And we were, or maybe we even still are, considering doing a podcast just about every single Bill Murray movie. And we started off doing an entire podcast about the very first Bill Murray movie and all sorts of crazy things about Bill Murray, who's one of my favorite comedic actors. So here's Mark Malkoff and I breaking down the good, the bad, the funny of Bill Murray. So, a brand new podcast dedicated to the movies of one of the most amazing actors of the past 50 years, Bill Murray. This is James Altucher with Mark Malkoff. Mark, how's it going?
This is good. I saw you did. You brought your research along.
I know. Well, I've got two books with me. The Tao of Bill Murray, which tells all these crazy stories you always just hear about where Bill Murray will go up to somebody, you know, surprise them, put his hands around their eyes, and then they turn around and they see Bill Murray, and Bill Murray will say, no one's ever going to believe this story. He has thousands of stories like this, and this book, The Tao of Bill Murray, is really great, describing a lot of those stories. And then there's this other book, Wild and Crazy Guys, about that whole generation of John Belushi, Bill Murray, Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd, Harold Ramis, that kind of came out of that National Lampoon, Second City, SNL culture to create all these movies from Animal House and going forward, all the Bill Murray movies, all the Chevy Chase movies, Steve Martin movies, and so on. So it's kind of a fascinating look at that generation. And the Tao of Bill Murray is a fascinating look at Bill Murray.
The Murray Story stuff, like I wasn't even going to talk about the Netflix one that's on Netflix, but just the Murray stories I've heard like the last like 10, 12 years. It is so hard to tell what's real and what's not. And then you have people online writing fan fiction type stories about Murray. And, you know, people, I think just the public, a lot of times it seems like they'll just latch onto something that may or not be true. And it becomes this myth that people say is true.
So you know, you there was this documentary about Bill Murray, which describes a lot of these stories. And I was thinking of you when I was thinking about doing a podcast just about the movies of Bill Murray, because you were in that documentary.
I am. Tommy Avalone, who's a really great director, asked me to do it. And I was like, no one's ever going to see this. And then I see on his Facebook, it's going to South by Southwest, and the New York Times is covering it. And then it's on Netflix.
I saw it on a plane.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Yeah. I've heard from
a lot
of people.
And then I saw you and on a plane. I'm like, that's Mark Malgoff.
He used to live on a plane. Yeah, it was really good. I mean, he did a fantastic job reaching out to these people that never told their stories before. And there is something about Murray's career and just his attitude that is different from, I can't think of anybody like it that has had longevity in this industry. It's something that I feel like hasn't been explored enough.
So before we get into his first starring vehicle, Meatballs, tell your story of how, like, why were you in that documentary?
I was in the documentary because I was under contract with a comedy website doing content. And I had the idea to try to get Bill Murray, because he does all these outrageous things. Not outrageous, but just very, I don't know, eccentric, just really interesting things. I thought that there would be a chance that if I called him, because I had just got the 1-800 number. I'm like one of the rare people. I still get people that message me asking for the 1-800 number, and I can't give it out.
What's the 1-800 number?
The 1-800 number exists because Bill Murray has not had an agent, certainly not a manager, for years. I mean, he was with Mike Ovitz at one point, but I think that was years ago. The only way to get to Bill Murray is to call the 1-800 number and hope you get a call back. And a lot of times it's radio silence. I mean, even Sofia Coppola, and Murray got nominated for an Oscar. I mean, she had to call multiple times over months.
Right, she called that 1-800 number for the movie Lost in Translation.
Yeah.
She wanted him to star in it.
Yeah.
She wrote it for him.
Yeah.
But she can't get a hold of him because he has no agent or manager.
A lot of it. I know one person was telling me, they called Murray's lawyer from like IMDb Pro and was like, I really want to get the script to Bill Murray. And he's like, what's your contact for Murray? And he repeats the 1-800 number, and the lawyer says, that's the only number I have for him as well. And this was true. I think it was St. Vincent's it was another movie that somebody's instructions were to leave a script somewhere outside the city in a phone booth. And that was one of the things. To get to him, there's this mystique about him, and it, rightfully so, that he just lives his life by his own rules, and he doesn't have to play the game like everyone else to keep working.
Well, and you know, and that begs the argument, does anyone really have to play the game? Because we're all kind of hypnotized into thinking we need to play this role. Like, we're all like kind of avatars in this game, this video game called Earth or the US or careers. And Bill Murray steps out of that game and actually wins because of it. He's sort of an example that once you stop defending yourself against all of the kind of social punishments, if you live outside the rules of society, you actually stop holding in your creativity, your authenticity, your integrity. Like, he is very uniquely himself and succeeds because of that.
That's what I was going to mention, authenticity, because I know people that know him, they've known him for years and years. And he can really spot, apparently, like, phoniness or people that are latching on for the wrong reasons really well. But the people I've talked to that have known him as acquaintances throughout the years since the 70s, up until now, I mean, talk about loyalty to his friends. And, you know, he definitely has had his ups and downs with, like, certainly Harold Ramis. Got to see him before he passed away. Dan Aykroyd does call him the Murricane sometimes, because you just never know what Bill Murray you're going to get.
And some of that will come up when we talk about Caddyshack.
Yeah, we'll talk about, oh gosh. Yeah, I know way too much about that. I shouldn't know, but I do. I've seen that so many times. But yeah, Murray, there's a detachment about him that I can't think of anybody else that is that detached. That just, I mean, this is, we're going to talk about the Meatballs that monologue, that like speech that's famous, but he really believes it. I think he really believes it, where so many people at the top, performers especially, are just like, you know, their whole life is staying on top and their whole, they're consumed constantly over their friends and family with their career. Murray is just, he's so far back from that and has still been able to succeed wildly. I mean, Bill Murray is one of those people that could work whenever he wants. He could be making several movies a year if he wanted to.
Like, literally, if he called up, you know, Warner Brothers and said, I want to be Batman, they probably would give it to him.
I think so. I mean, he's been such a box office attraction for so long. America, you know, they just supported him for so many years at the box office and his career, and he's beloved. I do, as I mentioned, it didn't get in the documentary. There is, like anybody, there's a, I think like when Dan Aykroyd called him the Murricane, there's definitely a different side when he's not happy. I've been told some of the things. I know, like, for example, I really like Scrooged, that Michael O'Donohue film, and I think, did Mitch Glazer write it with him or produce it? But I knew, I've been told, and I read it, that Murray was not happy during that filming. He was really unhappy with it. And, you know, they edit it together, and it's a huge hit. I saw it in the theater. I absolutely loved it, but I guess it was a departure from what Michael O'Donohue, who's one of the original Saturday Night Live writers, did. But, like, and also there's one, I know Charlie's Angels, he was really unhappy and clashed.
Oh, I forgot that.
So I think it's one of those things, like, the environment has to be right, and they just kind of have to let him do his thing. But anything with authority, anything, I think, like with the Charlie's Angels especially, if there's authority, an authority figure, and they try to really, you can maybe do that to other actors in the crew, but if you try to do it to Bill Murray, it's not going to go well.
Yeah, and you know, like with Meatballs, and again, we'll get more into it, but I don't think any of his lines were scripted. He sort of shows up the first day or the second day of filming and kind of looks through the script and throws it out.
That's what happened.
And improvises everything, including that famous speech that you were alluding to earlier. But I want to know, why, again, were you in the documentary? So you
Oh, yeah. Getting back to the reason I'm here. I was under contract with a comedy site, and I had this idea just based on all these eccentric, unusual things for somebody that's famous. I thought it would be fit if I tried to call the 800 number, I don't know, a couple times a month and just politely ask if he would come to my apartment in Queens for, was it dinner or lunch? And my wife, Christine, would make a meal. We would set it out for Murray. And then I would interview people that had experiences with him on it. And it took me about a month to realize, I'm like, I did not think this out right. And I say it in the documentary, because Murray is, he's an improviser from Chicago. And the whole thing that his life is based on Second City Improv, which is yes anding. It would have to be like, I'd have to see him at LGA or JFK or somewhere, like run into him in Chicago and be like, you know, Bill, could I do this thing on my iPhone where we have lunch or dinner? And he, you know, he either says yes and or no. But like for me to call the 1-800 number, and there are a lot of people that just never hear from him. I realized that it was not probably going to go well. And then other people are like, you should hang out at this place to run into him. I'm like, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to his, where his son works, whatever restaurant. Or like somebody was like, he's at the Oyster Bar right now at Grand Central. I'm like, no. I it would have to be for him to do something like that. Again, first of all, I would not do that for privacy reasons, but for him to say yes, it would just have to be one of those things where it just happened. Like, an example of him's yes and in is, I heard this story, and I believe this one is true, that he was in Chicago just walking down the street, and a breakdancer was like, come on, Bill, and Bill started breakdancing. I mean, that's the thing. He has these things that presented to him, and a lot of times the things that are unusual, he yes ands. He really just is that as a person that lives in the moment.
Or another story I heard is that he saw some party happening, I guess, in an apartment building or somewhere. He just goes in there, and it's like college kids or grad school kids, and he just starts serving beers out of the keg and not really commenting that he's Bill Murray. Everyone's saying that's Bill Murray, and he's just, hey, here's a beer, and he's just having fun with them.
And he was doing dishes at one of the parties. But the thing is, Bill Murray has been interviewed about this, and he won't deny it or confirm anything. So it's like some of the stories I would strongly guess didn't happen, but I think he just enjoys this
people could say, oh, it's easy for him to do now because he's so successful. But he was doing this before he was successful, ever
all
since
the time.
He was his Second City days or before.
Yeah. No, it was always that was his thing. Always before he was famous. And the people I know that talked to him just said he's like loyal guy in the moment. He's there for you. And he's just like, he lives his life how he wants to. I mean, they talk about in the doc that he's in, South Carolina? He's in Charleston a lot. And I think that they leave him alone and he just wants to be around people that are just hanging out. And, you know, if organically he runs into someone and they have this conversation, it's interesting. You know, Murray might say, let's get a drink, or do you want to like go to somewhere and watch a Cubs game or something?
And I feel though there's levels of when you say he just does what he wants to do, there's levels of that. There's like what you just described, like, hey, let's grab a drink. But then also I think for him, there is a clown-like aspect as well to his personality. And I don't mean clown in the sense of painting his face and wearing a red nose, but in terms of like entering into a situation as if it were a game, and how can he make it as almost as absurd as possible?
I love that point. No, that's, I think like in Second City, yes, and trying to hide in as much as possible. And I mean, just the stuff, the video I've seen of him with the River Dogs in Charleston, and just, you know, with the poetry, with the construction workers.
Well, what's the construction workers?
Oh, you do, Murray, for some reason, I don't know, I think it was the second time he's done it. He did poetry for construction workers down somewhere, I think it was in the Village. And they just kind of listened. And he was, maybe it was a poetry organization or something, but he's, once he latches onto something and believes in it and he like considers somebody a friend or something, I think he was doing it to support somebody. But yeah, it was just him doing poetry for construction
and
workers.
He commits to it like the way a comedian might commit to 100%. An act.
And I think like some of this stuff, I think he really, really believes in it. He might not necessarily think it's funny. I just think he like, he does his own thing. And he unlike anyone else I can think of, Jim Downey, who's a longtime Saturday Night Live writer, he's friends with Murray, and he wrote in the oral history, the Tom Shales, James Andrew Miller. That book, Downey said out of anybody he knows, and he knows a lot of famous people, Bill Murray, he's the only one that would kind of challenge or like not fully respect people of power that could directly affect his career. Like he didn't care. I'm paraphrasing, but like someone he mentioned someone like Harry Shearer, who sometimes he's always been nice to me, but I know sometimes people have had trouble with him. And I think his point was Harry Shearer, when he was around the people, the decision makers, was a different person, and Murray was not, and he just didn't care.
And Harry Shearer, just to he's in The Simpsons, right? What role did he play again in The Simpsons?
Oh my gosh, he played so many of the roles in The Simpsons, and then he was the Guffman, he's like with Chris Guest.
Waiting for Guffman.
Yeah, I don't know if he's in Guffman, but he's definitely
in Spinal Tap.
Yeah, Spinal Tap. No, I don't think Guffman, but like certainly a lot of the Chris Guest movies. And like he is like one of the he was a child actor with Jack Benny. I've spent some time with him. He was very nice to me. And he's one of those people that has just worked since he was a kid. And he's one of those people, like him and Buck Henry are the only two people I know that could read cue cards without ever looking them on site and just read as they go and make it work. Like basically, if we were playing a scene right now, I would just be reading up the cue cards for the first time, and the audience would have no idea that I didn't work on this scene or memorize it. So yeah, he can look at a script and audition in front of people never seen the script before and just do that. And Buck Henry has that thing as well. But for Murray auditioning, which he probably hasn't auditioned in 30 years, I'm guessing for an audition, he's given the sides, he's given a script, and he probably just crumbles it and does his thing.
When do you think, I don't know of actually any time where he's auditioned.
I really like
Did he audition
asking,
for Ghostbusters? Ghostbusters?
No. We'll talk. We can talk about that. No, he did not. He didn't
because I think John Belushi was John Belushi considered?
A couple of years ago when they were writing it, he was being considered because Aykroyd had that thing going for quite a while, and it was definitely a vehicle. I think Chevy Chase at one point. But what happened is Ivan Reitman And I don't want to give too much away just because we'll talk about Ghostbusters. But Ivan Reitman, and this pretty much happened with Meatballs. Ivan Reitman picked him up at the airport for Ghostbusters because he just wasn't sure if Murray was going to show up. He was very like, I'm not sure if he's actually going to do it. He said, maybe. But Ivan Reitman personally picked him up at the airport. And to Ivan Reitman's knowledge, Bill Murray had never even read a script at that point.
So I'm really curious about this style that Bill Murray has, which, unlike Robin Williams, who can play very serious roles in a very serious way, like he has this range from, you know, his stand-up comedy to funny, like there's the stand-up comedy, then there's funny, like in Good Morning Vietnam, and then there's really serious, like when he's, you know, Dead Poets Society and stuff like that. But Bill Murray does seem to have this philosophy in his persona that comes out in almost every single film. And again, I feel like it's this clown-like aspect. What do you think is the difference between a comedic actor, an improviser, a stand-up comedian, and again, this clown-like authenticity?
I think like the improviser, first of all, I think he's a playful person in general, a playful individual, and then it's just the improviser is just being in the moment. And it's just really being present, listening, and going with instinct, where most actors can't do that. I mean, they need the script, and they, you know, it's like a Bible to them with every word.
Right, which is why a lot of actors can't do public. Like you see at the Oscars, they're totally stiff when they have to read. You know,
oh, it's terrifying for them. Yeah. I mean, that's the reason. Like nobody can do that today, but that's the reason why so many of famous people back in the day wouldn't go on Carson or Letterman, and now everything's changed. Like De Niro or Pacino, Meryl Streep, none of them would go on those type of shows, but now that everything's changed and they have to sell their movies. But he's definitely watching last night. I watched Meatballs for the first time in a long time. He's definitely one of those people that just goes with his instinct and it seems to be there to have fun.
So like an improviser, let's say you're an improviser, you get a cue from the audience, like, you know.
Oh, yeah, like a suggestion maybe.
Right,
yeah,
and
yeah,
then you're with a group of people usually, and you do the yes and.
Yeah.
And then in a typical Second City type scenario is an improviser on the outskirts can say freeze and then jumps, you know, taps someone out and takes their place and the improvisation continues. And let's say I'll make the distinction between that and a clown. A clown is also taking cues, but mostly from the environment and situation and context around them and is kind of acting on their own.
And I think a clown really cares what the response is, and I don't think Murray cares. I think he's that detached where, I mean, he'd be like, I wish it went better, but I don't think he cares. I really, really don't. He was at Second City, I think it was 74 he got to Second City. Maybe it was earlier, and he had the mustache. And he was in the sketch shows, too, so they were doing, like, the sketch and then the improv. And it seemed to me that it happened really quickly because he got to Chicago. And before anything, like a year or two, I don't think he was at Second City that long. I could be off. He's here doing the National Lampoon thing. And they're seriously considering him for Saturday Night Live. For someone that started, I mean, he did plays and stuff, but I don't know. I could be off, but I thought his first professional thing was at Second City 74. Maybe it was 73. It certainly wasn't 72. He just wasn't really doing it that long. And normally, as we both know, it takes normally years and years. The people that I really like that are improvisers, a lot of times they cut their teeth in Chicago for at least like 4 or 5 years.
And people forget how many well-known actors have kind of quote-unquote graduated from Second City. There's like Steve Carell from The Office.
That's true.
Dan Aykroyd came from like the Canadian version.
He did. He was in Toronto. Everyone from Stephen Colbert to Tina Fey to Robert Klein, David Steinberg, Peter Boyle. Joan Rivers was there for a little bit too. Who else? I mean, definitely like John Candy and Mike Myers was up in Toronto, but did a little bit in Chicago when they switched. But yeah, for a long time, like Chris Farley, Tim Meadows, for a long time they were SNL was getting a lot of their people from Second City. It's kind of everything's changed right now, especially with UCB, and it's just the whole thing with the internet. Everything's changed, but that was the that's where Lorne Michaels would go. He'd go to Second City. He would go to the Groundlings and sit through stand-up showcases occasionally. And that's where they pulled most of their talent. And there's just something about Murray that, you know, Lorne Michaels always says it's three elements for somebody that that's going to have a successful career doing this as a performer. The first is talent, which there's a lot of people that are talented, and Murray especially. The second one is discipline, and Murray will tell you he's lazy. I've seen him in interviews being like, I'm a pretty lazy person. And then the third is luck.
But you know, let me just comment on lazy. I'll give a quote from Bill Gates. Bill Gates likes to hire lazy people because they're the best at figuring out how to do something in the most efficient amount of time.
That's a good point.
And you know, Bill Murray's, you know, I think, you know, some of these scenarios we're describing where he improvises, that's not laziness. I mean, that comes after a lot. He did work hard at Second City SNL and all these things.
Oh,
like,
when
he figured out how to do these scenes and how to this persona where that's what he could pull out to pull off any scene.
Once he's there, he's fully committed and focused 100%. He's there also to have fun. I mean, he's said, I was working with somebody that was their first movie, and he's like, I just wanted to show them you can how much fun you can actually have on a movie set. So he's definitely about that, but he's not one of these people that's constantly, he doesn't even have an agent, but he wasn't constantly calling Mike Ovitz or whoever he was represented in the 70s and 80s and be like, you have to get me a script. You have to get me a script. I want to do two projects this year, because, you know, most people that are in entertainment, and he's one of the rare exceptions, you have to show up constantly in front of the public, whether it's in a movie or TV or a talk show. Like, I think I was just talking about it with Mr. Steve Cohen, who's sitting over there. I think we were, actually.
Yeah, Steve Cohen?
Mr. Steve Cohen was talking about, wasn't it Ice-T you were talking to? Or I'm trying to remember who it was that said if they didn't show up for year.
I said
James.
Was it you?
Yeah, I was on Ice-T's podcast. Before the podcast started, I asked Ice-T, if you disappeared for 6 months completely, like no music, no acting, nothing, how long before people would stop talking about you? And he replied, 6 months, which was kind of depressing.
I think he was exaggerating, but like, it's the truth. Like, Rosie O'Donnell went to like the daytime, like, I mean, the most successful daytime show. I mean, the final offer was like $80 million to do one more season, and she wouldn't do it. And she left. And then, I don't know, a bunch of years later, she says she walks all over the place, and younger people have no idea.
Yeah, people only know her now from like Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, it's like like even Neil Diamond doesn't perform anymore, but every year he would make an appearance on the shows, like multiple, just to be like, I exist, I'm doing this. And then, you know, he was still selling at Madison Square Garden, but there's very few people that do not have to show up constantly, and Murray is one of those exceptions.
Do you think, I mean, this is really an unrelated, but do you think that's like an addiction, this need to show up? Like, why does Neil Diamond care?
It might be his other people, but Barry Manilow, I just think, like, to keep it going, it's like Coca-Cola advertises, even though they have that market, that's their market. I mean,
yeah, but if they don't advertise, though, their fear is Pepsi will pass them. But like Neil Diamond, he's made his money.
Yeah, true.
He's not going to have a brand new number one hit, most likely. You know, so his artistic, you know, integrity was sort of preserved in time from back in the day. He's not going to recreate it.
You know what my thing is, and I don't know if this is true or not, I think he's up in Malibu these days hanging out. But I've been in situations with people that when I was younger, or when I was with people that were way after Neil Diamond's time, his prime. And the moment being in a place when Sweet Caroline comes on, this 20-year-olds, they start going into it. And it's something about, maybe it's that one of those things still showing up and still like for the younger generations to know who he is and just, that could be it. But that is, you wouldn't think somebody like a Neil Diamond or like a Madonna or a McCartney, certainly, but somehow they all show up pretty regularly.
Yeah, and you can argue, well, they're making a lot of money every time they go on tour, but McCartney's already worth $1 billion.
Yeah.
And maybe he makes 50, 60 million a tour, but
he doesn't have to go on Fallon and do, I was there once, this really, I know some people over there, and this really, one of my friends over there was like, Mark, I can't tell you which show, but we have a big performer on one of the two shows. And thankfully, I picked the right one. And I was like, it has to be McCartney, because it's like, there's very few people that go on those shows that it's like, oh my goodness. And McCartney played, I think 3 songs aired, and he played 8 songs for the audience. And I know the same thing happened at Colbert. They played X amount of songs, but he did way more for the audience. He does not have to be doing that. He just doesn't. He went on Carson once and wouldn't even play music. They would try to get him to do music. And he rarely, almost never did those shows. But I think things have changed, especially with social media. I mean, I never thought Bob Dylan would be on Twitter, by the way. And it's never, he's not tweeting, but just the fact that he has a website and is handled on social media with something, I never thought.
But Bob Dylan is close to that ideal of kind of not caring that he's as relevant now as he was in the past. I mean, did he show up for winning the Nobel Prize, or did he not show up?
He didn't even respond to the offer. He did go to something at the White House where he got honored. President Obama put some medal around him, but he did not go to that. And I think he's just, he did a rare interview with Ed Bradley on 60 Minutes, the great late Ed Bradley. And the only reason, he hates doing interviews. This must have been his last maybe on camera with a journalist, because he had to, because he wrote a book for Simon & Schuster and he signed something that he had to do one of those. Same with Marlon Brando. He didn't want to do Larry King. These are guys that don't do this stuff. So Ed Bradley was asking Dylan about, he tours all the time. Like, you never see that guy, a public photo of him. He's either, you just always on stage when you see photos of that guy. And Ed Bradley was asking him about the touring, and he just said he made a deal with, Ed Bradley is like, is that with God or the devil? And Bob Dylan started laughing, but he basically made a deal at the start of his career that he was going to use this gift and just do it constantly.
Well, again, this is off the topic of Bill Murray, but it's related. Like, Bob Dylan in the mid-60s, I forget what concert it was, but he was known as this great songwriter and also a great folk singer. And then suddenly he opens up one concert with an electric guitar, and everyone starts booing him.
Gosh, that was in Rhode Island. That was, I could be off on that. But yeah, no, I mean, his fan base.
Yeah, he would always do things to kind of upset his fan base.
That's a good point.
He wouldn't care.
That's a good point. Like, Murray doing the Razor's Edge after Ghostbusters and taking a few years after, who would take... I mean, I just love this. Very 99.9% of people, like, you do Ghostbusters. It's like the biggest hit imaginable. Like, your face is everywhere. Most people would want to keep the momentum going. And he took, like, was it 2.5 years or two years off? And he was in France.
He moved from Hollywood to France because he knew it was going to be a big hit. He did not want to be bogged down by the Hollywood fame.
And he would, like, most people also, it's like they're going to stick to their niche, but he would only do Ghostbusters if he was able to do the drama, the Razor's Edge. So
right, that was the deal, right?
I heard.
He refused to do Ghostbusters unless they got to do something different.
He is like, that's a really good point with Dylan, because I've seen Bob Dylan perform twice, and if you see Springsteen, for the most part, he's playing the songs that people want to see him. And people are like, when he starts doing Badlands and everyone goes crazy. And Bob Dylan, his set list is what he wants to play. There might be 2 or 3 songs that, like, the public would know, but he gets on the synthesizer and starts playing and the keyboard. And like, most people are like, no. I can't think of anyone in music. Like, McCartney, when he plays, he said publicly, he's like, people are paying a lot of money. I have to deliver the hits. He's like, I can get in a few of what I want to play, but for the most part. And Dylan, he is kind of like Murray. He's just like, I'm going to throw out what I want to throw out. And I don't think he's ever plays more than like a handful of his, what the public would know.
Yeah, and you know, again, getting back to Murray, he's not, everybody sort of lumps humor and funny into one umbrella, but there really is a difference between a comedic actor, an actor who rises up from stand-up, and an actor who rises up from the improv world. And I'll even still include kind of a clown-like aspect as a separate category. A comedic actor will be great at the script and have kind of funny expressions and great timing, but still needs to stick to the script. So an example might be... Yeah,
that's true.
You know, someone like Jonah Hill has never done stand-up. As far as I know, he hasn't really done, you know, improv at a professional level, but he's a super funny actor. And then you have guys like Steve Martin, Eddie Murphy. These guys came up, Robin Williams came up from a stand-up world where it's... They created their act, but it was an act that they previously created, and then they perform it over and over again, and then they move into the acting world. And Bill Murray was not a stand-up comic. He was a great improviser and kind of taking his surroundings around him and the context and not necessarily trying to be funny, but using just his innate ability and years of practice at improvising to kind of find the absurdity in a situation. And usually that was like against authority or the common script we all play.
Yeah, like, I mean, he said he always would throw away the script until, it might have been the Wes Anderson movies or Lost in Translation, but he was always throw the stuff away and just do stuff and enhance it. But he would definitely, like, a movie like Stripes, there's definitely moments where he had to play it straight with Warren Oates, who was the great film star that passed away soon after that, where he could do the drama. I mean, he could easily do the drama and make a career out of it.
Yeah, and he does drama, like in Broken Flowers.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Jim Jarmusch. I mean, he was sensational in that, 100%. But he is one of those guys that can do both and play levels. And a lot of the stuff that he does comedy, there's still like the serious element. And he just plays it straight. Like, I've never seen that guy try to play a joke before.
Right.
I do think that's a good point.
He's not trying to play a joke. You can't write humor for him. Yeah. He's just going to do him. Yeah. And he's going to, again, find the BS or the absurdity in a context and express that with how he moves, which you see most of all in Caddyshack, for instance,
we'll
or what he says, or the tone of his voice, or how he treats the other, you know, players on the stage. And it's interesting to see, like, the difference between that and, like, you know, a Steve Martin, that, again, comes up through stand-up. You know, he basically got really good at doing, you know, a performance.
The one character.
Yeah. And you know, he's able to use that ability to kind of have these exaggerated performances, you know, in his future movies, but he's not improvising. As far as I know, he's reading the script.
I do think, before we move on, it is very important to talk about when Murray first showed up to the public in 1976, they did not like him. They did not like him on SNL. He was getting hate mail. You replaced Chevy Chase. We want him back. How dare you? And he really had to struggle. He was struggling to get over. I mean, anything new normally takes a while, but certainly with him, America did not embrace him right away.
Well, how old are you again?
I'll talk afterwards. I've been around a little bit.
So I remember when that first cast, you know, on SNL was sort of over and new players were entering. Everyone just automatically thought, I was just a little kid, but I remember people saying, like, everyone automatically thought, okay, that's it. That's the end of SNL. Now, of course, it tended to blossom over and over again. But because he replaced Chevy Chase, who went on to kind of this...
He was huge.
Yeah, this movie.
Chevy, after one season on SNL...
Yeah.
Was huge.
And then I forgot what his first movie was.
Oh gosh. I know I can mention a bunch of movies he did in the 70s leading up. I don't know what the first one would have been. I mean, I don't know.
The time he came
Foul
back,
Play maybe, or like Oh Heavenly Dog. I'm trying to think the 70s what the movies he was doing. And he did that one with Carrie Fisher that I have never seen. Was it Over the Rainbow? I mean, it has to be on YouTube, I'm guessing, but it's like that was a drama. But he did all these. I mean, he was under contract with NBC and he did a couple specials.
And then when he first came back to SNL to do a guest appearance after he had left, he and Bill Murray, there was so much tension. I don't know what the full story was, but they almost got into a fight.
Yeah.
And I think it ended up with Bill Murray basically saying, you know, kind of scoffing at him and saying mediocre talent and then walking away.
Chevy Chase has said that it was John Belushi who he was friends with kind of egging Murray on and saying this is how Chevy is. He's like this, grew up rich and is entitled and treating people like this. And Murray definitely is a tough kid from Illinois. And he went to Chevy's dressing room. He Murray started insulting him and saying something about Chevy's wife. And then Chevy said, at least my face doesn't look like Neil Armstrong landed on it. And there were definitely punches thrown and people were trying to, I mean, I'm trying to think of the people. Like, I think Brian Doyle Murray, Bill's brother, might have been there, but they definitely were separating them. They definitely landed a little bit, but not the full blows. And then Chevy had to go out in like 15 minutes and do his monologue like nothing ever happened.
Right. And then I think the next time they basically got together, from what I read, there was one brief encounter just randomly, but then it was basically on the set of Caddyshack a few years later. And they got together and there was some tension there.
Absolutely.
And there's an interesting, again, improvised scene in Caddyshack, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah, we'll talk about,
But it's fascinating to follow their relationship because, again, they were different styles, like Bill Murray being that
sort
of clown-like figure and Chevy Chase being an excellent comedic actor. Like, he had such a wide range of expressions and he plays that sort of white bread, rich kind of character very well.
Somebody was saying that he plays, it might have been Harold Ramis in an interview, said he's really, really good at playing the, like, being superior to everyone else type thing really, really well in comedy.
Like, I like Fletch.
Oh my gosh, that's the best. That and Funny Farm, I think, are his best work, his best movies. But yeah, Fletch was like the one Bill Murray thing where he kind of threw it away and did his thing. Oh, yeah, sorry, Chase threw away the script and did that. And he told me also, because he's been very nice to me. I've been with him only twice, but he's been very nice to me when we've worked together. He was telling me for Vacation, him and Harold Ramis, like, threw out pretty much most of John Hughes' script and just did that. They just would write as they went. And I just couldn't believe that when he told me that. But then, like, I found out Murray did the same thing. So the first six months, he couldn't get over. And then he did this one sketch where I think he was in the shower and using the soap as a microphone. And was he talking into the camera? But it was all like talking about how the audience didn't like him. And this was a sketch that was specifically defined. And maybe Lorne Michaels was helping with him to get over with the audience. And that was something that really did well. And I think that was kind of the breakthrough with that. Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned Harold Ramis. Harold Ramis, he was in Stripes with.
Yeah.
Harold Ramis helped write Caddyshack, Ghostbusters.
They did Groundhog Day together.
Groundhog Day, which is when their relationship kind of splintered.
That's what I heard.
And then there's also Ivan Reitman, who we did Bill Murray. That was Meatballs. Ivan Reitman produced that. And then later Caddyshack and also produced Ghostbusters, I think. And it's interesting. Like, again, we say so-and-so is lazy, but what's fascinating to me is, you know, there's that saying, you're the average of the five people you spend your time with. And, you know, people, success, there's no such thing as self-made success. Like, people kind of grow up in a career as a group. So Bill Murray pretty quickly associated himself. He wasn't just kind of like walking around in a daze, even though it was hard to get a hold of and had, you know, various, you know, you'd have to convince him to do a movie and he didn't really care about the results, it seems. But he did associate early on with Ivan Reitman, with Lorne Michaels, with Harold Ramis. Yeah. You know, Harold Ramis, Harold Ramis says the phrase, you know, always stand next to the smartest person in the room. And he says, I stood next to Bill Murray. And the way he met Bill Murray, and this is related to our later discussion on Caddyshack, the way he met Bill Murray was, I guess Bill Murray and his brother Brian were working as caddies. And I think Harold Ramis was as well.
I didn't know that. I know that they worked as caddies, but I certainly didn't know that's how they met Ramis. Wow.
I was not sure either, but now I've read this from two different sources.
Great.
That Harold Ramis basically bought hot dogs from Bill Murray, who was working at the hot dog stand on the ninth hole of this golf course in Illinois.
Maybe it was Will Matt. That's, I think, where Murray lived at the time.
They grew up in Illinois, I think. And Harold Ramis said, this guy's the funniest guy, and they just kept staying in touch and trying to work together.
Interesting. And then Harold Ramis at Second City, and then I don't think I Maybe they crossed paths at Second City for a while, but I don't think too long, maybe a year. But yeah, I mean, definitely. But I would argue, other than Lorne Michaels on SNL, like everybody from Ivan Reitman to Harold Ramis, they, it seems like to me that most of the time they would go to Bill and be not literally on their hands and knees, but like they would have to be so persistent to have him do it. I mean, even with the they were going to do a Ghostbusters thing before like Kristen Wiig and all those other amazing, you know, like Leslie Jones and all of them, Kate McKinnon. You know, they were in Toronto for some film festival, and you know, it was the first time because Reitman was calling Bill Murray and he wouldn't return the calls. So it was the first time that they were at a restaurant or a bar and they shut down. So it was just the two of them. And he was trying to talk about Ghostbusters, of getting back to the Ghostbusters. And Murray just was like, I just want to talk about you and me and all of that. So it seems like way more that the people needed Murray rather than Murray needed anybody.
Right. Well, and again, I think that that's the interesting thing. That's why we're talking about all this, is because not just that is the movies are so great and so interesting, but Bill Murray himself is kind of, it's kind of interesting to figure out what to emulate in his person, in his philosophy of life. You know, that's why this book about Bill Murray is not just the biography of Bill Murray, it's the Tao of Bill Murray. He has this interesting perspective on life. So I imagine when he's sitting down with Ivan Reitman, he's doing what feels right to him rather than kind of jockeying around something he doesn't really want to do, which is be associated with the latest Ghostbusters. He wants to rekindle a friendship, a lifelong friendship that is much more meaningful to him than the Ghostbusters franchise. But this segues into Meatballs because, you know, so it's his first starring role. Ivan Reitman had, I guess, directed him on the National Lampoon show, and they knew each other. And Ivan Reitman wrote this part specifically for him, but Bill Murray was not famous at all. I think he had done
one season of SNL.
Apparently, he had a $300 a month loft in New York. I think in either the Soho or Tribeca area. So he was committed that summer to traveling around with this minor league baseball team that his friend had bought, and that's all he wanted to do. He said it was the summer of 78. He just wanted to play baseball. And Ivan Reitman couldn't get a hold of him. So Ivan Reitman would send the script to every baseball stadium, hoping that Bill Murray would read it. And then the night before they were going to start filming, you know, apparently Reitman had auditioned other people, but had no clue what he was going to do. Like he didn't know if Murray was going to show up.
He had no idea if Murray was going to show up. They did have a few minor conversations leading up, but no commitment. But my point is anybody that was after SNL that was there for a season would be like, I just have to keep getting exposure. And they would be all about their agent or managers or whoever doing a high profile thing. And Murray just couldn't care less that he was getting his starring role, that they were just giving this to him. He just didn't care.
And you see that happen with actors now is, okay, let's say an actor has this huge breakout hit. Like, let's say Zach Galifianakis in The Hangover.
Yeah,
okay, nobody had heard about him outside of the comedy world. Nobody had heard about him.
Like the alt comedy world.
Before The Hangover. But then suddenly you have a hit like that. And this is not just about him. This is about any actor, really. The correct strategy is to say yes to every single movie possible. And we're seeing this with Tiffany Haddish right now, too. Say yes. And it's a good strategy. Say yes to every possible movie offer. Collect your millions, and then you could be more
selective a little bit and just keep showing up in front of the public. Yeah.
But Bill Murray, who had yet to even have a starring role in something, was just so blasé about Meatballs, even though kind of had, you know, everybody actually thought it would be a hit because it was being considered the potential Animal House of summer camps.
Oh, 100%.
John Belushi break out so much. And just the night before filming started, Bill Murray agreed to be in it.
He showed up. There's an oral history, I think Vanity Fair, and he showed up in a Hawaiian shirt, and that's what he wears in the beginning of the movie.
He threw away the whole, all the clothes that they had in the, what do you call it, the dressing room. He threw out his whole wardrobe and just wore the clothes he showed up in.
It's like the costume department. Those people are so talented. They get paid so much money to do that, and Murray's just like, no, we're not doing this. And nobody can argue with him. And
did you feel, looking at his clothes, by the way, when you were watching Meatballs last night, you were watching it?
Yeah.
Did you feel that his clothes were a little bit kind of off-putting?
What he was wearing, yes, his outfit and his shoes. And then I read the Vanity Fair article and I was like, okay, this makes much more sense.
Because it did actually feel a little bit, and you appreciate what goes into wardrobe, felt like even like the colors were a little bit off to me.
It seemed like his outfit, he just didn't care. Whoever did his outfit, and I didn't know it was Murray himself, just didn't care. And I, there's something great about that.
It ultimately goes with the character.
It really, really does. And then again, Reitman said that when they handed him the script, whatever, the first day or whatever, he just threw it in the trash can, the garbage can.
Yeah, and then he every single line afterwards, he improvised. And then as the character, the other thing that's interesting, by the way, in the very beginning is, he never wore makeup in the movie, and I don't know if that has ever happened before.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I've never heard of somebody making a motion picture, especially starring, that didn't do it. With makeup. I have to say, as funny as Bill Murray is in that movie, he has these tender scenes with Chris Makepeace.
Yeah.
And there are levels. And there's that one scene where Chris Makepeace is himself in the diner and Murray comes in and he's wearing some hockey jacket or something. And he just sits down with him. And there's something really tender about it. But it does seem like that movie would be almost like a Chris Guest movie where they have the pivotal plot point set up, but everything else is like, do your thing and go.
So. Oh, I didn't know that's how the Chris Guest movie.
Yeah, go. Normally what they do is they have a very light outline. Even like Larry David with Curb, it's like this outline. It's a rough outline, but it's there. And then just, let's see what happens.
Look, and that works. Like,
if you get smart people, talented people, yes.
Yeah, because they're all trying to make each other laugh in the scenes, and the laughter is actually really real as opposed to scripted. But the whole Bill Murray, Chris Makepeace thing, they weren't really going to make that. That wasn't as much in the script. Like, you know, really the script. So okay, the Meatballs movie, just to quickly summarize it, it's a summer camp experience. There are campers. There's kind of the director of the camp. There's Bill Murray, who's the head counselor, and then there are these CITs, counselors in training. And the movie is originally supposed to focus on these CITs, the counselors in training, and kind of their romantic intrigues and the funny things, you know, again, Animal House-like things they do to each other. And there's kind of the poor camp where Bill Murray is, and there's the rich kids camp, Camp Mohawk, and they're supposed to compete. Again, it's very modeled like Animal House, but then Bill Murray, because his personality is so large and so beyond the script, sort of kind of becomes the soul of the movie, and his relationship with one camper, Chris Makepeace, mm-hmm. they have to write more and more for Chris Makepeace because that really becomes the heart of the movie.
Yeah, it's a really, really touching thing. I read also that Ivan Reitman said the first screening was a disaster, and he said there has to be more Murray in it. I guess he didn't say it in post-production, and it was like, we have to throw in way more Murray, and they did, and that's ultimately what got the public into the movie.
You know, I just want to add one more thing about the makeup. I think it's very interesting because now, you know, since we were kids, you know, screens have gone from essentially low quality, you know, to HD TV quality, and like I've been on a lot of news shows, I've always refused makeup, and I've been on news shows since 2004, and I remember even in 2004 someone was telling me, when there's eventually high density television, everyone wearing makeup is going to look stupid.
It's true. I mean, I've been on the Today Show on the weekend, and they like sprayed me, like normally they put the makeup on, this looked like a spray thing, and on one of the appearances I'm like, I do not look like this is but yeah, I definitely think that I get that approach now, but back then, Murray, inconceivable.
Why do you think he refused the makeup?
Yeah, I wonder if he did that on his other things.
By the way.
No, you can't. I couldn't tell. No, I couldn't tell anything. But then again, if he says no makeup, it's no makeup. If they told him to cut his hair, that wasn't happening.
Yeah, because his hair was like all over the place.
Most people, when they're making their first movie, would defer to the producer, and they would have no, they realized they would have no leverage and would just be there to please. And Bill just did not care.
And do you think it was so clear to Ivan Reitman, and this is to Ivan Reitman's credit, recognizing the talent of Bill Murray so early on. Like, it was so clear. Do you think it was so clear to Ivan Reitman that, look, let this guy just do his thing because that's what will make the movie a hit?
Oh, 100%. I mean, Bill Murray, especially with that and this stuff, he just brings something to the table that is not in the scripts. I mean, yes, the Wes Anderson and Sofia Coppola are exceptions, but no, he just brings himself, which is something... Like Lorne Michaels said those three things, and Bill Murray says he's lazy, but those that he has, like, that talent factor, there's just something about him. I remember when I went to see Ghostbusters, it was because of Murray. I mean, yes, Ray Parker Jr. thing, but I was there to see Murray. I mean, I would see, if Murray was there, I would be like, we're going to see this. And I can't really think of too many other, like, Star Wars movies were like that, but I can't think of anything else. Like, I knew, like, when, like, Chevy Chase Fletch, I'm like, I'm going to be there the first day.
Right, but I wouldn't always automatically see every Chevy Chase movie.
I wouldn't, but there was something about Murray that if it was a, yeah, I mean, I had to be there. I remember one of my friends when I was in Arlington Heights named Morris Lee. We were best friends. We were really good friends. But he was like, we were going back and forth. He's like, I want to see The Karate Kid. No, we have to see that first. I'm like, no, Ghostbusters, Bill Murray. So we saw Karate Kid first, and it was very good. But then we finally saw Ghostbusters, and I saw it in the theater. And it was like, at the time, it was just like the laughs coming. And it was like, but the thing is, there was kids in the theater, and there were grown-ups. And Murray transcends age. He really, really did. I mean, I just remember as a kid, finding Bill Murray as funny as my dad and people that were maybe older than him, which a lot of times that doesn't, you know, what adults find funny isn't necessarily what kids find funny.
Well, you think about it, kids don't know all the social rules yet, so they'll be more physical. Mm-hmm. They'll have eye contact longer with people. Yeah. They'll, you know, want things more and need things more and ask for things and do what and buck authority a little bit more. You know, they'll cry for attention. And, you know, for instance, like, again, in one of the first scenes of Meatballs, he's giving that, you know, there's some kind of news team, a reporter asking, like, you know, what's it like to spend $1,000 a week at Camp Mohawk, which is the other camp, the rich kids camp. And Bill Murray is pretending, and it's all improvised, he's pretending to be kind of the head of Camp Mohawk, and he takes on this, he you know, he goes down an octave, he's like very serious, but he's totally just playing, and he says, like, oh, you know, they get, you know, these, you know, high-end...
Like Sadat, it was like somebody, yeah, from it to come for to the kids, talk to the kids for a week. It was just the most ridiculous things, and the guy who's interviewing, it's over his head.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was... That was definitely, I mean, there's just countless stuff that I think of, especially if Ivan Reitman would to be doing commentary on it, and I don't know, that I just think it's, yeah, Bill just doing his thing. You know, you are limited. When you're doing improvisation like that, you are very limited to what the cameras can do. But, I mean, if you say you can go from here to here, do your thing, he makes every single thing he's given. He uses that entire thing.
Right, and again, it's... it's like this adventure. So given a set of situations, and we've talked about some stories that he does in real life, what's the adventure he can have? So given where the cameras are, given what's happening on the scene, you know, just the idea that he could just go into that scene and improvise this whole thing where he's, you know, this wasn't in the script at all, where he's, you know, the Camp Mohawk guy and describing this ridiculous scenario of what happens to what the kids get for their $1,000 a week in summer camp. It's just, you know, it's almost like he's trying to challenge himself in each scene to see how ridiculous he could be, but within the context. He like you say, he doesn't jump out of the cameras.
Yeah.
He's still in there.
He's playing it straight. I mean, I know.
Right, he's playing it straight. He's not making a joke.
We all know people that have been successful with comedy, but they're winking at the camera, which is a different approach. It's just, I'm not saying which is better. I like Murray's approach.
Right, he's not acting outlandish.
No.
You know?
No. I mean, everything that he's doing, like, he's being playful, but it was all like in the realm of this could happen and somebody could be like this, and it was all 100% believable. And I would also say with this movie, when he would improvise, it made everyone else look better because they would just kind of follow his lead, and it didn't seem out of place. It never felt out of place.
Yeah, because then What would I like the word playful? I think what he's doing is he's playing. You know, every situation kind of sets up a different set of rules, and he's playing in the best way he can, and that's what he does in every scene. And what happens is, Chris Makepeace is this kind of lonely, sort of bullied in the beginning kid, and he and Tripper, the head counselor that Bill Murray plays, build this relationship where Bill Murray is trying to get Chris Makepeace out of his shell. And of course, the reverse is happening as well. In classic rom-com fashion, you know, Chris Makepeace is trying to get Bill Murray to open up romantically to the actress Kate Lynch, who plays, you know, the main female.
Yeah, she's great. Character. She does a fantastic job.
Yeah. And I like the scene where they're gambling peanuts.
Yeah, that's a great with the car. Yeah, they're
and Bill Murray is like giving various kind of semi ridiculous life lessons to Chris Makepeace, yeah. And Chris Makepeace is sort of like half knows they're ridiculous, but is also taking it seriously, and you know, really, you know, likes this relationship he's developing with Tripper, and they go running together, and it really becomes this. That becomes the soul of the movie.
I love it because like most people that were doing comedy would just go gag, but there's so much of that movie with him that is just this tender side to him, which I have to say a lot of people would be, I would think would be too insecure to go there when they're doing comedy, and they just are like, that we need to laugh on every other page or something like that. And he was, I mean, they're definitely doing the Tripper with Chris Makepeace. There were some laughs, but they weren't like the big laughs. I mean, it was just kind of like a tender, you were kind of touched by it, and there were laughs in it, but not like the big, like we're going to go for the big laugh sketch type things.
Right, because I think the context, again, almost makes it ludicrous. Like here's this adult, sort of adult guy. Like, I don't know why he's the head counselor at this summer camp, and he seems much older than that. But, right, so there's this older guy who's building a friendship with this young, sort of shy, quiet kid, and almost that context is what makes it funny, that Bill Murray is treating that, he's almost treating that situation like they're equals.
He is.
And the way he does that makes it, that in itself makes it ludicrous. The more he treats that situation seriously, that makes it funny.
He doesn't condescend. There's no
never condescends.
Like, he doesn't like play. He's always playing up to the top of his intelligence, like an improviser does. But with Chris Makepeace, he does. He's like on the same level. He treats him not like a kid. Like that, he matters. He's valuable. There's something great. One point I want to make, and I want to see what you think, is if I had to guess, I think there is a correlation between how good the movie turns out and how much fun he's having off camera. Because I know the Meatballs, they were like, and for definitely Caddyshack, they were just having so much fun, the time of their lives. I think they were definitely having fun making the movie. But I mean, behind the scenes, I mean, it was party central, and they were having a good time.
For Meatballs?
Yeah, like I know for like Bryan Cranston would say for, and I get this.
Wait, Bryan Cranston?
No. I was going to say when he was doing Breaking Bad, it was like they would rap and he'd be back in wherever his home or wherever in New Mexico, just focusing on the lines and everything else. There wasn't partying going on. I mean, it was not like that. And some comedy people would too be, I just have to get my lines and be in the zone. And Murray's just like, at the end of the day when they say cut, I'm just like, let's have a good time and have fun. And I know that there was a lot of fun on that set and Caddyshack. And I just was wondering if when that happens, that correlation, the performance is even, I don't want to say better because he's always good, but maybe even more loose.
Well, it's interesting you say that because off camera, Bill Murray teaches Chris Makepeace how to shave. So they did build kind of that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
Of sort of this, you know, this tender sort of relationship offstage as well. And
yeah, that's true. So
it's interesting you say that because maybe that kind of fueled, you know, the emotions they were feeling in the different scenes.
I like it. I mean, there was Jason, I can't believe Jason Schwartzman was on Conan like a year or so after Rushmore, which is like the thing that really got him, the public to know who he was, like a year or two, and said Murray took him out to dinner before they shot, and they'd never met each other. And Murray was just, you know, he was serious but playing around. And at the end, when the check, Murray just kind of like did this to like signify that the kid was playing, that Jason Reitman was playing, was going to have to pay. And Reitman thought it was so funny. And it was just, I think that that is something like that when he's, especially with people that are significantly younger than him, I definitely think it's that thing where they definitely have a relationship off camera, because we know so many people that are in the industry where it's like cut, they go to their trailers and they're not even like, they don't have a relationship with the person. But there's something about Murray, especially with the younger people, where I think he cares. I think that there's definitely heart, that he's taking care of somebody. Like Murray's older than Wes Anderson, but when they were doing the movie with Gene Hackman, when they were doing, I'm so tired, I should have slept. When they were doing, Steve Cohen, help me out.
Gene Hackman?
I can't believe, he got nominated for an Oscar. I am so tired. Okay. They filmed it uptown in Harlem.
Let's see.
I have Royal the soundtrack, Tannenbaum. The
Tannenbaums. Oh, Royal Tannenbaums.
So when they were doing Tannenbaums,
thank you.
I can't believe people are listening. Please forgive me. when they were doing Tannenbaums, I saw that in the theater. Gene Hackman was definitely not thrilled with, and was giving Wes Anderson a really hard time and being just not nice. And Bill Murray was very protective of Wes Anderson. And I think it's that, I don't know if it's an avuncular thing or a paternal thing, but with somebody that is younger, especially, it's very, very protective. I know that another film he said, it was like really, really cold, but I mean, there were kids there, and that's when he like just lost it, because he was just like, the kids are cold. Like, he's like, for me, whatever. But he definitely, I think, when he senses that something is being unjust to somebody that can't defend themselves, especially, I mean, yeah, he just feels very protective and will take matters in his own hands.
Maybe that natural sense for him is what, again, fueled that relationship with Chris Makepeace, which really made the movie. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
The kind of premise of the movie is a little weird. Like, when you're watching it, you don't think it's weird, but there's no counselors in the movie. There's all counselors in training.
Yeah, it's really,
and you
different.
Never really see the campers either.
Yeah, not too much. And like,
even the big contests and stuff are all between the CITs.
That's true. I never thought about campers. That logic. Yeah, some of the logic, I'm sure, is thrown out the door. I personally, it didn't bother me, but I'm yeah, that is an excellent point. And another point is with who they hired, for the most part, they were not trained comedy people. Like Chris Makepeace was, did he get any laughs in the movie? I mean, he was like a drama guy.
So.
I mean, My Bodyguard, he was, and I loved it. I mean, that's what I loved is that I think that normally the gut is to go with all trained improvisers, definitely trained. Like when I watched Jump Street, one of the Jump Street movies, the woman was so funny. Is like at the end, it's like it's revealed she was the one, the bad guy, and she was so funny. And in my head, I'm like, she's a Groundlings or Second City person, and I was just convinced. And then I googled, and it was Groundlings, which is fine. She was so funny, got all these laughs. But I really do like when they go the other way with some of these people that are just not necessarily comedy people.
Yeah,
I think it works.
Yeah.
I like it. I mean, they were in Canada, and didn't they cast like some of the parts with people that had never been in movies before?
Yeah, and I don't think they ever were in movies
again. And there's something beautiful about that.
I mean, even Chris Makepeace was in my Bodyguard.
Yeah, yeah.
And drama. Maybe a couple other things, but not
a lot.
As an adult, I don't think he's been in anything.
A drama, they put him in this thing, and they could have easily chartered a plane with all Second City people, easily, or find these funny kids and go up to Canada and have this movie where everybody's funny. And they just didn't go for that. And I loved it. I mean, there was definitely this realness about it. And again, there were gags, but it didn't feel like it had to be gag after gag. And the gags weren't over-exaggerated. I didn't think so. Like, I mean, some of the way that they played them, I would say, the way that they acted them, they weren't playing them over the top, which you see a lot of times.
No, it was really the funniest parts is when Bill Murray was acting overly serious, kind of against authority.
So like
there were gags where some of the CITs were taking, you know, the director of the camp, Morty something, to, you know, putting his bed in the river.
Yeah, that was like a running gag that they would do that. But they did it in a, like, he'd wake up and he'd be like all upset and panicked, but be playing it real. It wasn't like, I didn't see him going for laughs. I really, really didn't. And the way that they did that, even that scene when they're, the improvised thing, when they're, well, it's probably in the script where they're taking the bed and they strap him down and he's sleeping. The way Murray's doing it with the counselors, it didn't seem to me like they were going for laughs. Even
no, because he was acting
funny.
Like almost like a drill sergeant.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Tilt it this way. Okay, move out this way.
I just think it was one of those things where, he's like, we're going to play this like it was real. And I think that there's something beautiful about that. I mean, clearly in stripes all throughout that, which another one is Murray throughout the script. He's just improvising and finding these moments with these people, finding real moments. He did that in Caddyshack, obviously, as well, with these people. A lot of them that didn't have that much training, if any training, and just was able to get these other people to react in the moment with him that didn't have regular training. I think there's something very disarming about him.
Right.
I think,
And contrast that with, let's say, another summer camp movie, which was almost a parody movie, but, you know, Wet Hot American Summer.
Sure, yeah.
And
yeah.
That was an ensemble cast of basically stand-up comedians.
It was all common. And then you had Bradley Cooper. And you had people that, like, Amy Poehler, I don't think was established by then, but it was
Michael
all comedy.
Showalter.
Yeah, no, it was all comedy. It was like, Jeanine Garofalo, Molly Shannon, really, really funny people. The cast, you can't argue that against the talent and they're funny, but it was exactly that. It was all comedy people, except for maybe, I don't think that Bradley Cooper was trained in comedy at that point or known as comedy, but he was more like the bad guy anyway. So
And that movie definitely, it was great for what it was, which was kind of like a gag, you know, the gags move that movie along, but it didn't have that tenderness.
There was not even close.
And the tenderness was almost funny in Meatballs because it was ridiculous.
I would say so much of that comedy, the tenderness doesn't exist, and if it does, they just do it really briefly at the end to try to justify the comedy and stuff, and to like it's very brief and forced. Not always, but I feel like that's an easy technique. But those guys, David Wayne and Showalter. I don't know who directed that Wet American Summer, which again, fill a room of people with that. It is really a really funny movie, but the tenderness thing it wasn't there. And there's definitely those Murray movies within the comedy that those tender moments are there. I mean,
And then, you know, there's kind of that, maybe the most memorable scene in the movie was his speech.
Oh, gosh. Where, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, like, and you know, they're about to play, or they're in the middle of playing Camp Mohawk in the Olympiad. Camp Mohawk's destroying them or is about to destroy them. And, you know, Bill Murray just starts yelling like it just doesn't matter over and over again until they're all going with him. And he's like smashing things and it's all improv.
Yeah.
I think even the line, it just doesn't matter.
I read something, I could be off, that Ivan Reitman was saying in the oral history that they just had dinner together or something or coffee. And they were trying to beat out this scene. And I think it was Murray that was just like, something they agreed it just doesn't matter would be the thing, but they had no idea what that would turn into. But they knew they needed the speech, and then Murray, you just let him go.
But you know, I feel again, what happens off camera with him happens on camera. Like that philosophy of doesn't matter.
Yeah,
you know, it's the theme of basically all his movies. It's the theme of all these off camera stories where he just go shows up at a party and starts serving
There's
drinks.
A lot of that, and that's made in that Tommy Avalone's wonderful documentary. They talk about that. They talk about that scene and those words and how it parallels his life, his choices, and his roles. Ghostbusters is one. I don't want to talk about Ghostbusters yet because there's so much to talk about Ghostbusters.
Yeah, that's
But
huge.
His career is just talking about Meatballs. There's only a few things I really remembered from that movie going in that I remember the theme song, Are You Ready for the Summer? I definitely remembered
I like that song.
Murray with the hook. That's improvised when he's telling the camp story, all improvised, and then he brings out the hook. But there's so much other stuff that I think maybe just being older, especially like with more of an adult eye, there's just so many things I didn't notice in that movie that I really, really
liked. Like what?
Well, I just did. If I had to guess, like, tell me what Meatballs is. I would say it was gag, 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 gag. And I didn't realize how much, like, Murray especially and the female lead, what's her name again? She was so good. Murray's love interest. How there were tender moments and they were playing it straight. And I don't think I remembered how much of it was played straight and real.
And he's vulnerable in there. Like, 100%. At the end, they're deciding to live together.
Yeah.
And he's a little nervous about committing to it.
Oh, I forgot about how much of that was contained in the film. And I was showing Christine Stripes, and she wasn't she wasn't into Stripes. Part she was, but by the time it just got to, she's like, I can't get into this. And we stopped watching. But even Stripes, which is like another thing, gag, gag, gag. There's moments with him, with Murray, same thing, with him, with tender moments as well.
I guess you're right. Like, when I think, what do I remember as a kid? I sort of think I was laughing nonstop. But when you actually watch the movie, he's funny and it's a funny movie, but it's not like this nonstop laughter. It's like really interesting, deep humor. And then I think this, It Just Doesn't Matter, becomes this sort of rallying call to action for all the kids and even now adults who watch the movie. It's a very kid-like attitude.
And it can be really successful, the detachment. I mean, one of my friends who's a stand-up, I think it was Craig Baldo, put on Facebook that Murray said in an interview, if you can detach, and you can do, like, you'll do your best work if you just don't care. And Baldo, who's a really funny guy, was just like, it's so hard to do that.
Yeah.
But he is able to do that, and some people can just do it. And I definitely think when people are more relaxed, just completely relaxed, they're going to do their best work.
Well, but that's interesting, though, because people always say, particularly for improvisation or stand-up, everyone always says, be yourself. But that doesn't actually mean anything, because we're different versions of ourselves depending on the situation, usually. But Bill Murray seems to have cracked a code, and you see it first, really, in his movie career, in Meatballs. He seems to have cracked the code on what it means to be authentically himself on the screen.
His skill set, I'm sure there's a few other people, but to throw away a script, make it funny, genuine,
without telling a single joke,
not going for like the really broad laughs. I'm sure that if we thought about it, I'm sure we could maybe come up with a few people, but not many.
Robin Williams in the early days.
Yeah. I don't know if they really, I mean, oh yeah. I mean, him and Jonathan Winters especially. I mean, that's a good point. But you know, that was like with commercials, it was whatever, 25, 26 minutes. But to do a thing with a movie with an arc and really be able to still tell the story and not make the plot suffer, and still, like, really, because there are some movies where the arc is sacrificed of the story, and the story is just for the jokes, and it's like the jokes have to serve, and just the comedy and just the performances have to serve what the story, overall story, is and the message. That's what I get.
Yeah, and I think maybe we can say the overall message of Meatballs, what I get out of it, is this phrase, it just doesn't matter. And the way that became this kind of the call to action that basically inspires the entire camp and then inspires the audience. And it's not just him saying it, it's him in acting that way in every scene. It just doesn't matter. And yet things work out for him. He meets the girl, they move in together. And by the way, the other thing that's different between seeing it as a child and seeing it as an adult, didn't think that Kate Lynch was that attractive when I was a kid. She wasn't like the platonic ideal of beauty for an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, but now when I see it, she's, you know, she's a very beautiful woman.
Yeah, she's attractive. No.
You can see what he sees in her. And then I want to ask you what you think of this in terms of his romantic scenes. You know, he first tries to win her over. He kind of physically tackles her.
Culturally wise, no.
I don't think you can do that now. But apparently he did that in real life, too.
Oh, really?
That was his courtship technique in real life.
Oh, I didn't know that. Amy Poehler, I think, is the one I read an interview in the last year that said comedy does not age well. And certainly that was the scene that stuck out that I was like, I didn't remember it, and just watching it, I was like, that was the one thing that stuck out.
But again, he was being true to himself. And yes, it doesn't age well, but that is apparently how he acted in real life then.
Yeah, and I, you know, I have no idea about, I didn't know about that. But yeah, if that's the way he was doing it in real, he definitely seemed real to me. I mean, it was playfulness, but definitely that it definitely in today's standards and rightfully so crossed a line.
But and I've seen a recent interview with Ivan Reitman where he says, "Oh, you could tell it was just playful," but I think clearly it crossed a line.
If it did.
Was aired today,
I mean, Harold Ramis and was saying with Vacation, he like was doing commentary, and it was the scene. I think they're in St. Louis, and it's like they're in a place that doesn't have a lot of a section of the city that doesn't have a lot of money, and they have all these gags. And he's like, "I'm not proud of this. I'm not proud of this scene." And at the time, I know the theater full of people were laughing, but looking back at certain things, yeah, that was the only thing I could think of that, and maybe there were more that really stuck out for me. I want to talk about one more point about It Just Doesn't Matter. Something about that, there's the pressure. I mean, people are so nervous to do things. And if you can really do abide by that, like, it just doesn't matter. It's just like,
yeah,
the pressure is like, people are going to do their work better, but I certainly can't do that all the time. I mean, I think we can try to, and I think if we try to do that, maybe we can be better at it, but Murray seems to be wired like that.
And there's boundaries to it still. It doesn't mean go out and like murder people you don't like.
No, of course.
But he goes to the outer limits of those boundaries.
It's in context.
To find where the play, where the maximum playfulness is. And it seems like he does that in every situation in his life.
It just doesn't matter within something that's safe, that's not going to hurt people.
And it's important in the context that he wasn't rich and famous then.
No.
But that was his underlying philosophy somehow.
Yeah, he was... When I talked to somebody that right when he was getting famous before, they said he was the same Bill Murray. And, you know, some people when they get famous, they just want to be around their Hollywood friends. And Murray is loyal to people that were not famous that he knew at SNL. I mean, when he goes to the, I heard from several people when he would go and at the after party, when if he hosted or if he was visiting, he'd be with the crew. He would sit down with the crew guys. I mean, and I know when he did Jane Pauley, he was friendly with her. She had a very, like for one season, she had a show that was taping at NBC, and Murray did her show. Because again, Murray's like, I don't have to do this. Like, I was thinking, how did Jane Pauley get Murray to do this? Because he doesn't do many of these things. And I'm like, out of loyalty, that was it. And I was told by somebody that after he was with Jane Pauley, he went up to 8H and just wanted to hang out with all the crew guys. Hmm. Says a lot.
Well, one last question I have for you. You mentioned Chevy Chase's insult to Bill Murray, like, it looks like your face, you know, Neil Armstrong.
Thing,
And, you know, he has all these kind of, I guess he had acne as a kid and there's all these kind of scars. And yet, he's never portrayed, and no one in any movie, no one ever calls him an ugly or unattractive guy.
He
it has
never
this, what I like to call this ugly charisma. Like, he's so charismatic and so comfortable with himself in every situation
that
makes him a very attractive person.
Yeah, even like when he's playing a not likable person until the end with Scrooge. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I definitely think, I think that's a good point. Really quick, and then we can go back to this, is my point is when he visited everyone at SNL after Jane Pauley, the crew, those were the people that were there when he was their 70s. I mean, this was like 25 years later, and he just wanted to go back and see his friends. I mean, they weren't famous, and that's who Murray is from people I've talked to that aren't famous that told me.
So it seems like he valued, it's just like that what scene you described where he's talking with Ivan Reitman. Reitman wants to talk business, and Bill Murray values the relationships much more than the business. It's almost like the business is not real to him. Like, that either happens or it doesn't, but the relationships are real. And, you know, we'll eventually talk about The Razor's Edge, which is a super serious
100%
movie. And the fact that he wanted to make that, you know, there's large elements of that movie that are based on real life, you know, spiritual gurus in India from like the 1930s, 1920s, 1910s, where their inherent philosophy is that nothing matters, that people don't really, you know, all of these things that we view as important are really just man-made, and you just have to focus on your own kind of internal peace. And the fact that, you know, Bill Murray must have been exposed to that at some point, those philosophies, so much that he wanted to make that movie, you know, kind of also is a sort of a little bit of a light that shines on you know, all of this stuff we're talking about.
Yeah, I wonder how much he was affected when he was in France for those years. Because I knew he did Ghostbusters if he could make. I didn't know if it was that movie, but something.
No, it was
drama.
That movie.
It was okay. Good.
That
okay.
was the deal. Before
so it was.
Ghostbusters.
I knew it was like a drama, but I didn't know the studio was like, okay, we'll let you do that.
He specifically was not going to do Ghostbusters unless they let him do Razor's
Edge. Yeah, I'm not really sure his trajectory, like in terms of his philosophy with that type of stuff when he was on SNL, because I mean, Ghostbusters was 84. He had been out for 4 years, and between that time, he made Caddyshack. He did, I think, Stripes. And my guess is he probably did maybe one other thing. Maybe he did two things.
I mean, prior to Meatballs, he did you know, Where the Buffalo Roam about 800 Thompson. I actually never saw that.
There was in the oral history of Vanity Fair, they talk about that. That was like during when it first came out, that he was and still like dressed up like Hunter Thompson because he was about to make that film. Something about Murray when like they said this is what I want to say. In the Vanity Fair, they said it's like it just came out, and they were in a limo and just like having a good time. And they stopped at a theater. Murray had never seen a crowd. There's like 400 people, and they snuck in the back. And Murray was like watching some of like the scenes that he did, and he just was he seemed so happy that they were like, first of all, that they got laughter, but like even like the speech, that it just got such a big reaction, because there's nothing really that funny in that speech. Mm. It's more just him, but that it just resonated with people.
Yeah. There's one other thing I wanted to say. Oh,
about the film?
Yeah. This is just about Bill Murray in general in terms of talent. Yeah. Like, obviously, his brothers were, he had many brothers.
Oh, gosh. There were so many brothers and sisters. Caddyshack, the opening of Caddyshack is based on that. That's why it's the house full of like all those kids. It's like 20 kids.
And his brother, Brian Doyle Murray, was a co-writer on Caddyshack. But then I didn't know this until literally the other day. I just recently rewatched the entire series of Mad Men. I binge-watched in like 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
All seven seasons of
Mad
Men.
Yeah,
I've seen
them.
Did you know Freddie Rasmussen, that kind of alcoholic guy mm-hmm. who's fired in season one? Mm-hmm. He's Bill Murray's brother.
Yeah, Joel I did Murray. Know that because I saw a movie when he was a kid, and I recognized him. And I'd always like at the end wanted to know what Matt Weiner was going to choose for the closing credits. And then I saw his. Yeah, he's the guy on the show, right, that was had a drinking problem.
Yeah.
And it culminates with some big beats. But yeah, he was so good on that show.
Yeah,
I like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a different kind of talent. He was a talented actor.
Yeah, he's talented. He was at Second City. And Brian Doyle Murray still works.
I don't know if I've seen him in something where I don't recognize him. Like, I don't know what I've seen him in. Has he been an actor in anything?
I'm like trying to think now off the top of my head.
Writer?
Well, he was on a TBS sitcom that I never saw with Steve something was a comedian for his vehicle. And it was like set in a bar, like an Irish bar, I think. And then he was in Wayne's World as like the Noah's Arcade owner, and they make fun of him. He's definitely in Caddyshack as the guy. He's with the mustache that is kind of like ordering all the caddies and like will like yell at them when necessary.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. That's
so interesting because he looks like sometimes I confuse him for Bill Murray.
Yes, and then he's in Vacation. Is a funny scene where Chevy Chase is like. He keeps ringing a bell. They're outdoors and he wants a tent and he keeps ringing it. And the guy comes out with watermelon and takes the bell away from Chevy Chase. And it's this really subtle thing, but he plays it very, very well. But when I was a kid, I couldn't tell that they were the same person. I couldn't. I mean, yeah, I had no idea until later. And I'm trying to think what else he was in, but he's been in a bunch of stuff. And he's definitely, obviously, a funny guy to write. Great Caddyshack, which was based on being a caddy and having a house full of siblings.
Yeah, and so Meatballs, the budget, they only gave Ivan Reitman a $1.6 million budget to make an entire movie.
What would that today be, I wonder?
It'd be
like
about five or six times as much.
Would it be? Okay.
So I was
still
going
to guess like 5 or 6 million. Yeah, I mean,
But they rented out a summer or some summer camp. Let them use the facilities.
Yeah, it was a real place, which I should have brought up.
Only a few speaking parts. It's wonderful. None of the campers speak.
They're not on a back lot. They're not in a sound stage. They could have easily done the interiors in a stage, but yeah, no. There's something great. It was a real place, and
like now it would be an indie movie. Yeah. But then that was the hit of the summer in 1979.
Because who do they have to? No, it was enormous. I mean, for the amount of money that it made, for what is it like?
$50 million in the ultimate box
amazing.
Office.
Amazing. Like, who did they have to really like? Murray, I don't know what he was not established. I mean, I hope he got a good money. And Ivan Reitman, but I'm trying to think like none of the other cast was established. Maybe Morty was like he was a character actor. He did, but like
did John Landis direct?
John Landis didn't direct that one. No, that was. John Landis did direct. What did he direct? Did he direct anything with Murray? I mean, he did Three Amigos. He did a bunch of stuff with Eddie Murray. I don't know. We'd have to look at Landis's body of work. Ivan Reitman, I'm pretty sure directed that one. It was like, Ivan Reitman paid, but like, there's nothing like big budget about it. Like that's what I love. There's not like
Chris Makepeace is his first thing.
Yeah, there's nothing that they're trying to pull off that like we don't have the budget to do. And I think sometimes like this is a Lorne Michaels thing. Sometimes when there's rules that or you're limited, that's actually a good thing. Like they didn't like I'm glad that they didn't have $10 million because like I don't know what they would think that we have to do something with this.
Yeah.
And
a big explosion somewhere.
It was better on a shoestring. It really, really was.
Yeah. Well, Mark, what'd you think? This is the first episode of analyzing the movies of Bill Murray. Do you enjoy talking about Meatballs?
I love this. And I was coming over. I was thinking. I was like, how long is this going to be? I'm like,
I thought it might be like 10 minutes.
I told my wife this morning. I'm like, I can probably talk Meatballs for 20 minutes. I said maybe James knows much more, but I'm looking over at Jay at how long we've recorded, and I imagine it's a lot longer than we thought. How long was it, Jay, roughly?
It's close to 90.
90 minutes?
Oh, my
Woo!
God. On Meatballs.
Yeah. This was fun. I mean, this was easy and organic and no notes in front of us. I mean, I know that we both of us are big doing the prep, and I did very light prep as you did. So, yeah, this was fun.
Excellent. Well, this is the first of analyzing all of the Bill Murray movies, and stay tuned for Caddyshack.
Looking forward to it.
You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant, with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.